Hi there. I'm going to be frank with you. This actually took a lot more time to put together than I thought it might. I don't want your pity, I'm just telling you now that the 200th episode of Miette's Bedtime Story podcast might be more along the lines of something John Cage might put together, so you should savour and enjoy this one while you can. Of course, after listening to it, you might hope for some John Cage, and that's okay too, because it is the 20th of February 2006, and at long last, it's Miette's Bedtime Story podcast. It Had to Be Murder by Cornell Woolrich, part 1 of 2. I didn't know their names. I'd never heard their voices. I didn't even know them by sight, strictly speaking, for their faces were too small to fill with identifiable features at that distance. Yet I could have constructed a timetable of their comings and goings, their daily habits and activities. They were the rear window dwellers around me.
Sure, I suppose it was a little bit like prying. Could even have been mistaken for the fevered concentration of a peeping Tom. That wasn't my fault. That wasn't the idea. The idea was, my movements were strictly limited just around this time. I could get from the window to the bed, and from the bed to the window, and that was all. The bay window was about the best feature my rear bedroom had in the warm weather. It was unscreened, so I had to sit with the light out, or I would have had every insect in the vicinity on me. I couldn't sleep because I was used to getting plenty of exercise. I'd never acquired the habit of reading books to ward off boredom, so I hadn't that to turn to. Well, what should I do? Sit there with my eyes tightly shuttered? Just to pick a few at random. Straight over, and the window square, there was a young jitter couple, kids in their teens, only just married. It would have killed them to stay home one night. They were always in such a hurry to go. Wherever it was they went, they remembered never to turn out the lights. I don't think it missed once in all the time I was watching. But they never forgot altogether, either. I was to learn to call this delayed action, as you will see. He'd always come skittering madly back in about 5 minutes, probably from all the way down the street, and rush around killing the switches. Then fall over, something in the dark, on his way out. They gave me an inward chuckle, these two. The next house down, the windows already narrowed a little with perspective. There was a certain light in that one that always went out each night, too. Something about it. It used to make me a little sad. There was a woman living there with her child, a young widow, I suppose. I'd see her put the child to bed and then bend over and kiss her in a wistful sort of way. She'd shade the light off of her and sit there painting her eyes and mouth. Then she'd go out. She'd never come back till the night was nearly spent. Once I was still up, and I looked and she was sitting there motionless with her head buried in her arms. Something about it. It used to make me a little sad.
The third one down no longer offered any insight. The windows were just like slits in a medieval battlement due to foreshortening. That brings us around to the one on the end. In that one, frontal vision came back full depth again since it stood at right angles to the rest, my own included, sealing up the inner hollow all these houses backed on. I could see into it from the rounded projection of my bay window as freely as into a dollhouse with its rear wall sliced away and scaled down to about the same size. It was a flat building. Unlike all the rest, it had been constructed originally as such, not just cut up into furnished rooms. It topped them by 2 stories and had rear fire escapes to show for this distinction. But it was old. Evidently hadn't shown a profit. It was in the process of being modernized. Instead of clearing the entire building while the work was going on, they were doing it a flat at a time in order to lose as little rental income as possible. Of the 6 rearward flats it offered to view, the topmost one had already been completed but not yet rented. They were working on the 5th floor one now, disturbing the peace of everyone all up and down the inside of the block with their hammering and sawing. I felt sorry for the couple in the flat below. I used to wonder how they stood it with that bedlam going on above their heads. To make it worse, the wife was in chronic poor health too. I could tell that, even at a distance, by the listless way she moved about over there, remained in her bathrobe without dressing. Sometimes I'd see her, sitting by the window, holding her head. I used to wonder why he didn't have a doctor in to look her over, but maybe they couldn't afford it. He seemed to be out of work. Often their bedroom light was on late at night behind the drawn shade as though she were unwell and he was sitting up with her. And one night in particular, he must have had to sit up with her all night. It remained on until nearly daybreak. Not that I sat watching all the time. But the light was still burning at 3 a.m. when I finally transferred from chair to bed to see if I could get a little sleep myself. And when I failed to and hopscotched back again around dawn, it was still peering wanly out behind the tan shade. Moments later, with the first brightening of day, it suddenly dimmed around the edges of the shade, and then shortly after, not that one, but a shade in one of the other rooms, for all of them alike had been down, went up, and I saw him standing there, looking out. He was holding a cigarette in his hand. I couldn't see it, but I could tell it was that by the quick, nervous little jerks with which he kept putting his hand to his mouth, and the haze I saw rising around his head. Worried about her, I guess. I didn't blame him for that. Any husband would have been. She must have only just dropped off to sleep after night-long suffering. And then, in another hour or so, at the most, that sawing of wood and clattering of buckets was going to start in over them again. Well, it wasn't any of my business, I said to myself. But he really ought to get her out of there. If I had an ill wife on my hands...
He was leaning slightly out, maybe an inch past the window frame, carefully scanning the back faces of all the houses abutting on the hollow square that lay before him. You can tell, even at a distance, when a person is looking fixedly. There's something about the way the head is held, and yet his scrutiny wasn't held fixedly to any one point. It was a slow, sweeping one, moving along the houses on the opposite side from me first. When it got to the end of them, I knew it would cross over to my side and come back along there. Before it did, I withdrew several yards inside my room to let it go safely by. I didn't want him to think I was sitting there prying into his affairs. There was still enough blue nightshade in my room to keep my slight withdrawal from catching his eye. When I returned to my original position a moment or two later, he was gone. He had raised two more of the shades. The bedroom one was still down. I wondered vaguely why he had given that peculiar, comprehensive, semicircular stare at all the rear windows around him. There wasn't anyone at any of them at such an hour. It wasn't important, of course. It was just a little oddity. It failed to blend in with his being worried or disturbed about his wife. When you're worried or disturbed, that's an internal preoccupation. You stare vacantly at nothing at all. When you stare around you in a great sweeping arc at windows, that betrays external preoccupation, outward interest. One doesn't quite jibe with the other. To call such a discrepancy trifling is to add to its importance. Only someone like me, stewing in a vacuum of total idleness, would have noticed it at all. The flat remained lifeless after that, as far as could be judged by its windows. He must have either gone out or gone to bed himself. Three of the shades remained at normal height, the one masking the bedroom remained down. Sam, my day houseman, came in not long after with my eggs and morning paper, and I had that to kill time with for a while. I stopped thinking about other people's windows and staring at them. The sun slanted down on one side of the hollow oblong all morning long, then it shifted over to the other side for the afternoon. Then it started to slip off both alike, and it was evening again, another day gone. The lights started to come on around the quadrangle. Here and there a wall played back like a sounding board, a snatch of radio program that was coming in too loud. If you listened carefully, you could hear an occasional click of dishes mixed in, faint, far off. The chain of little habits that were their lives unreeled themselves. They were all bound in them tighter than the tightest straitjacket any jailer ever devised, though they all thought themselves free. The jitterbugs made their nightly dash for the great open spaces, forgot their lights. He came careening back, thumbed them out, and their place was dark until the early morning hours. The woman put her child to bed, leaned mournfully over its cot, then sat down with heavy despair to redden her mouth. In the fourth floor flat, at right angles to the long interior street, the three shades had remained up, and the fourth shade had remained at full length all day long. I hadn't been conscious of that because I hadn't particularly been looking at it or thinking of it until now. My eyes may have rested on those windows at times during the day, but my thoughts had been elsewhere. It was only when a light suddenly went on in the end room behind one of the raised shades, which was their kitchen, that I realized that the shades had been untouched like that all day. That also brought something else to my mind that hadn't been in until now. I hadn't seen the woman all day. I hadn't seen any sign of life within those windows until now. He'd come in from outside. The entrance was at the opposite side of their kitchen, away from the window. He'd left his hat on, so I knew he'd just come in from the outside. He didn't remove his hat, as though there was no one there to remove it for anymore. Instead, he pushed it farther back to the back of his head by pronging a hand to the roots of his hair. That gesture didn't denote removal of perspiration, I knew. To do that, a person makes a sideways sweep. This was up over his forehead. It indicated some sort of harassment or uncertainty. Besides, if he'd been suffering from excess warmth, the first thing he would have done would be to take off his hat altogether. She didn't come out to greet him. The first link of the so strong chain of habits, of custom, that binds us all, had snapped wide open.
She must be so ill she had remained in bed, in the room behind the lowered shade, all day. I watched. He remained where he was, two rooms away from there. Expectancy became surprise, surprise and comprehension. Funny, I thought, that he doesn't go into her, or at least as far as the doorway, look in to see how she is. Maybe she was asleep and he didn't want to disturb her. Then immediately, but how can he know for sure she's asleep without looking in on her? He just came in himself. He came forward and stood there by the window as he had at dawn. Sam had carried out my trace quite some time before, and my fights were out. I held my ground. I knew he couldn't see me within the darkness of the bay window. He stood there motionless for several minutes, and now his attitude was the proper one for inner preoccupation. He stood there looking downward at nothing, lost in thought.
He's worried about her, I said to myself, as any man would be. It's the most natural thing in the world. Funny, though, he should leave her in the dark like that, without going near her. If he's worried, then why didn't he at least look in on her on returning? Here was another of those trivial discrepancies between inward motivation and outward indication, and just as I was thinking that, the original one, that I had noted at daybreak, repeated itself. His head went up with renewed alertness, and I could see it start to give that slow, circular sweep of interrogation around the panorama of rearward windows again. True, the light was behind him this time, there was enough of it falling on him to show me the microscopic but continuous shift of direction his head made in the process. I remained carefully immobile until the distant glance had passed me safely by. Motion attracts. Why is he so interested in other people's windows, I wondered detachedly, and of course an effective break to dwell on that thought too lingeringly clamped down almost at once. Look who's talking. What about you, yourself? An important difference escaped me. I wasn't worried about anything. He presumably was. Down came the shades again. The light stayed on behind their beige opaqueness, but behind the one that had remained down all along, the room remained dark. Time went by. Hard to say how much. A quarter of an hour? 20 minutes? A cricket chirped in one of the backyards. Sam came in to see if I wanted anything before he went home for the night. I told him no, I didn't. It was all right, run along. He stood there for a minute, head down. Then I saw him shake it slightly, as if at something he didn't like. What's the matter? I asked.
You know what that means? My old mammy told it to me, and she never told me a lie in her life. I never once seen it to miss, either. What, the cricket? Anytime you hear one of them things, that's a sign of death someplace close around. I swept the back of my hand at him. Well, it isn't here, so don't let it worry you. He went out muttering stubbornly, "It's somewhere close by, though. Somewhere not very far off. Got to be." The door closed after him, and I stayed there alone in the dark. It was a stifling night, much closer than the one before. I could hardly get a breath of air even by the open window at which I sat. I wondered how he, the unknown over there, could stand it behind those drawn shades. Then suddenly, just as idle speculation about the whole matter was about to alight on some fixed point of my mind, crystallize into something like suspicion, up came the shades again, and off it flitted, as formless as ever, and without having had a chance to come to rest on anything. He was in the middle windows, the living room. He'd taken off his coat and shirt, was bare-armed in his undershirt. He hadn't been able to stand it himself, I guess. The sultriness. I couldn't make out what he was doing at first. He seemed to be busy in a perpendicular, up-and-down way rather than lengthwise. He remained in one place, but he kept dipping down out of sight and then straightening up into view again at irregular intervals. It was almost like some sort of calisthenic exercise, except that the dips and rises weren't evenly timed enough for that. Sometimes he'd stay down a long time, sometimes he'd bob right up again, sometimes he'd go down two or three times in rapid succession. There was some sort of a widespread black V railing him off the window. Whatever it was, there was just a sliver of it showing above the upward inclination to which the window still deflected my line of vision. All it did was strike off the bottom of his undershirt, to the extent of a 1/16 of an inch, maybe. But I haven't seen it there at other times, and I couldn't tell what it was.
Suddenly he left it for the first time since the shades had gone up, came out around it to the outside, stooped down into another part of the room, and straightened again with an armful of what looked like varicolored pennants at the distance at which I was. He went back behind the V and allowed them to fall across the top of it for a moment, and stayed that way. He made one of his dips out of sight, and stayed that way for a good while. The pennants, slung across the V, kept changing color right in front of my eyes. I have very good sight. One moment they were white, the next red, the next blue. Then I got it. They were women's dresses, and he was pulling them down to him one by one, taking the topmost one each time. Suddenly they were all gone. The V was black and bare again, and his torso had reappeared. I knew what it was now, and what he was doing. The dresses had told me. He confirmed it for me. He spread his arms to the ends of the V. I could see him heave and hitch as if exerting pressure, and suddenly the V had folded up, become a cubed wedge. Then he made rolling motions with his whole upper body, and the wedge disappeared off to one side. He'd been packing a trunk, packing his wife's things into a large upright trunk. He reappeared at a kitchen window presently, stood still for a moment. I saw him draw his arms across his forehead, not once but several times, and then whip the end of it off into space. Sure, it was hot work for such a night. Then he reached up along the wall and took something down. Since it was the kitchen he was in, my imagination had to supply a cabinet and a bottle. I could see the two or three quick passes his hand made to his mouth after that. I said to myself tolerantly, "That's what 9 men out of 10 would do after packing a trunk. Take a good stiff drink." And if the 10th didn't, it would only be because he didn't have any liquor at hand. Then he came closer to the window again, and standing edgewise to the side of it, so that only a thin pairing of his head and shoulder showed, peered watchfully out into the dark quadrilateral, along the line of windows, most of them unlit by now, once more. He always started on the left-hand side, the side opposite mine, and made his circuit of inspection from there on around.
That was the second time in one evening I'd seen him do that. Once at daybreak, made 3 times altogether. I smiled mentally. You'd almost think he felt guilty about something. It was probably nothing, just an odd little habit, a quirk, that he didn't know he had himself. I had them myself, everyone does. He withdrew into the room, and it blackened out his figure, passed into the one that still lighted next to it, the living room. That blackened next. It didn't surprise me that the third room, the bedroom with the bronze shade, didn't light up on his entering there. He wouldn't want to disturb her, of course, particularly if she was going away tomorrow for her health, as his packing of her trunk showed. She needed all the rest she could get before making the trip.
Simple enough for him to slip into bed in the dark. It did surprise me, though, when a match flare winked sometime later, to have it still come from the darkened living room. He must be lying down in there, trying to sleep on a sofa or something for the night. He hadn't gone near the bedroom at all, was staying out of it altogether. That puzzled me, frankly. That was carrying solicitude almost too far. 10 minutes or so later, there was another match wink, still from that same living room window. He couldn't sleep. The night brooded down on both of us alike, the curiosity monger in the bay window, the chain smoker in the fourth floor flat, without giving any answer. The only sound was that interminable cricket. I was back at the window again with the first sun of morning, not because of him. My mattress was like a bed of hot coals. Sam found me there when he came in to get things ready for me. "You're going to be a wreck, Mr. Jeff," was all he said. First, for a while, there was no sign of life over there. Then suddenly I saw his head bob up from somewhere, down out of sight in the living room. So I knew I'd been right. He'd spent the night on a sofa or easy chair in there. Now, of course, he'd look in at her, to see how she was, find out if she felt any better. That was only common, ordinary humanity. He hadn't been near her, so far as I could make out, since 2 nights before. He didn't. He dressed, and he went in the opposite direction, into the kitchen, and wolfed something in there, standing up and using both hands. Then he suddenly turned and moved offside, in the direction in which I knew the flat entrance to be, as if he had just heard some summons, like the doorbell. Sure enough, in a moment he came back, and there were 2 men with him in leather aprons, express men. I saw him standing by while they laboriously maneuvered that cubed black wedge out between them, in the direction they'd just come from. He did more than just stand by, he practically hovered over them, kept shifting from side to side. He was so anxious to see that it was done right. Then he came back alone, and saw him swipe his arm across his head, as though it was he, not they, who was all heated up from the effort. Oh, shit, lost my place. So he was forwarding her trunk to wherever it was she was going. That was all. He reached up along the wall again and took something down. He was taking another drink. 2, 3. I said to myself, a little at a loss. Yes, but he hasn't just packed a trunk this time. That trunk has been standing packed and ready since last night. Where does the hard work come in? The sweat and the need for a bracer? Now, at last, after all these hours, he finally did go into her. I saw his form pass through the living room and go beyond, into the bedroom. Up went the shade that had been down all this time. Then he turned his head and looked around behind him. In a certain way, a way that was unmistakable, even from where I was. Not in one certain direction as one looks at a person, but from side to side, and up and down, and all around, as one looks at an empty room. He stepped back, bent a little, gave a fling of his arms, and an unoccupied mattress and bedding, upended over the foot of a bed, stayed that way, emptily curved. A second one followed a moment later. She wasn't in there. They used the expression delayed action. I found out then what it meant. For 2 days, a sort of formless uneasiness, a disembodied suspicion, I don't know what to call it, had been flitting and volplaning around in my mind, like an insect looking for a landing place, more than once, just as it had been ready to settle, some slight thing, some slight reassuring thing, such as the raising of the shades after they had been down unnaturally long, had been enough to keep it winging aimlessly, prevent it from staying still long enough for me to recognize it. The point of contact had been there all along, waiting to receive it. Now, for some reason, within a split second after he tossed over the empty mattress, it landed. Zoom! And the point of contact expanded, or exploded, whatever you care to call it, into a certainty of murder. In other words, the rational part of my mind was far behind the instinctive subconscious part. Delayed action. Now the one had caught up to the other. The thought message that sparked from the synchronization was, "He's done something to her." I looked down at my hand. It was bunching the goods over my kneecap. It was knotted so tight. I forced it to open. I said to myself, steadyingly, "Now wait a minute. Be careful. Go slow. You've seen nothing. You know nothing. You only have the negative proof that you don't see her anymore." Sam was standing there looking at me over from the pantryway. He said accusingly, "You ain't touched a thing, and your face looks like a sheet." It felt like one. It had that needling feeling, when the blood has left it involuntarily. It was more to get him out of the way and give myself some elbow room for undisturbed thinking than anything else that I said, "Sam, what's the street address of that building down there? Don't stick your head too far out and gape at it." "Something or other Benedict Avenue." He scratched his neck helpfully. "I know that. Chase around the corner a minute and get me the exact number on it, will you?" "What do you want to know that for?" he asked as he turned to go. "None of your business," I said, with the good-natured firmness that was all that was necessary to take care of that once and for all. I called after him just as he was closing the door. "And while you're about it, step into the entrance and see if you can tell from the mailboxes who has the fourth floor rear. Don't get me the wrong one now. And try not to let anyone catch you at it."
He went out mumbling something that sounded like, "When a man ain't got nothing to do but just sit all day, he sure can think of the blamest things." The door closed, and I settled down to some good constructive thinking. I said to myself, "What are you really building up this monstrous supposition on? Let's see what you got." Only that there were several little things wrong with the mechanism, the chain belt of their recurrent daily habits over there. 1. The lights were on all night the first night. 2. He came in later than usual the second night. 3. He left his hat on. 4. She didn't come out to greet him. She hasn't appeared since the evening before the lights were on all night. 5. He took a drink after he finished packing her trunk. But he took 3 stiff drinks the next morning, immediately after her trunk went out. 6. He was inwardly disturbed and worried, yet superimposed upon this was an unnatural external concern about the surrounding rear windows that was off-key. 7. He slept in the living room, didn't go near the bedroom during the night before the departure of the trunk. Very well. If she had been ill that first night and he had sent her away for her health, that automatically canceled out points 1, 2, 3, 4. It left points 5 and 6 totally unimportant and unincriminating. But when it came up against 7, one hit a stumbling block. If she went away immediately after being ill that first night, why didn't he want to sleep in their bedroom last night? Sentiment? Hardly. 2 perfectly good beds in one room, only a sofa or uncomfortable easy chair in the other. Why should he stay out of there if she was already gone? Just because he missed her, was lonely? A grown man doesn't act that way. All right. Then she was still in there. Sam came back parenthetically at this point and said, "That house is number 525 Benedict Avenue, the fourth floor rear. It got the name of Mr. and Mrs. Lars Thorwald up." "Shh,"
I silenced, and motioned him back out of my ken. First he wants it, then he don't, he grumbled philosophically, and retired to his duties. I went ahead digging at it. But if she was still in there, in that bedroom last night, then she couldn't have gone away to the country, because I never saw her leave today. She could have left without my seeing her in the early hours of yesterday morning. I'd missed a few hours, been asleep, but this morning I had been up before he was himself. I only saw his head rear up from the sofa after I'd been at the window for some time. To go at all, she would have had to go yesterday morning. Then why had he left the bedroom shade down, left the mattresses undisturbed until today? Above all, why had he stayed out of that room last night? That was evidence that she hadn't gone, was still in there. Then today, immediately after the trunk had been dispatched, he went in, pulled up the shade, tossed over the mattresses, and showed that she hadn't been in there. The thing was like a crazy spiral. No, it wasn't either. Immediately after the truck had been dispatched, the trunk, that did it. I looked around to make sure the door was safely closed between Sam and me. My hand hovered uncertainly over the telephone dial a minute. Boyne, he'd be the one to tell about it. He was on homicide. He had been, anyway, when I'd last seen him. I didn't want to get a flock of strange dicks and cops into my hair. I didn't want to be involved any more than I had to, or at all, if possible. They switched my call to the right place after a couple of wrong tries. I got him, finally. Look, Boyne, this is Hal Jeffries. Well, where have you been the last 62 years? He started to enthuse. We can take that up later. What I want you to do now is take down a name and address. Ready? Lars Thorwald, 525 Benedict Avenue. Fourth floor rear. Got it? Fourth floor rear. Got it. What's it for? Investigation. I've got a firm belief you'll uncover a murder there if you start digging at it. Don't call on me for anything more than that. Just a conviction. There's been a man and wife living there until now. Now there's just the man. Her trunk went out early this morning. If you can find someone who saw her leave herself, marshaled aloud like that and conveyed to somebody else, a lieutenant of detectives above all, it did sound flimsy, even to me. He said hesitantly, well, but then accepted it as was. Because I was the source. I even left my window out of it completely. I could do that with him and get away with it because he'd known me years. He didn't question my reliability. I didn't want my room all cluttered up with dicks and cops taking turns nosing out of the window in this hot weather. Let them tackle it from the front. Well, we'll see what we see, he said. I'll keep you posted. I hung up and sat back to watch and wait events. I had a grandstand seat, or rather a grandstand seat in reverse. I could only see from behind the scenes, but not from the front. I couldn't watch Boyne go to work. I could only see the results, when and if there were any. Nothing happened for the next few hours. The police work that I knew must be going on was as invisible as police work should be. The figure in the fourth floor windows over there remained in sight, alone and undisturbed. He didn't go out. He was restless, roamed from room to room without staying in one place very long, but he stayed in. Once I saw him eating again, sitting down this time, and once he shaved. And once he even tried to read the paper, but he didn't stay with it long. Little unseen wheels were in motion around him. Small and harmless as yet, preliminaries. If he knew, I wondered to myself, would he remain there, quiescent like that, or would he try to bolt out and flee? That mightn't depend so much upon his guilt as upon his sense of immunity, his feeling that he could outwit them. Of his guilt, I myself was already convinced, or I wouldn't have taken the step I had. At 3, my phone rang. Boyne calling back. Jeffries, well, I don't know. Can you give me a little more than just a bald statement like that? Why, I fenced. Why do I have to? I've had a man over there making inquiries. I've just had his report. The building superintendent and several of the neighbors all agree she left for the country to try and regain her health. Early yesterday morning. Wait a minute. Did any of them see her leave, according to your man? No. Then all you've gotten is a second-hand version of an unsupported statement by him, not an eyewitness account. He was met, returning from the depot, after he'd bought her ticket and seen her off on the train.
That's still an unsupported statement once removed. I've sent a man down there to the station to try and check with the ticket agent if possible. After all, he should have been fairly conspicuous at that early hour. And we're keeping him under observation, of course, in the meantime, watching all his movements. The first chance we get, we're going to jump in and search the place. I had a feeling that they wouldn't find anything, even if they did. Don't expect anything more from me. I've dropped it in your lap. I've given you all I have to give, a name, an address, and an opinion. Yes, and I've always valued your opinion highly before now, Jeff. But now you don't, that it? Not at all. The thing is, we haven't turned up anything that seems to bear out your impression so far. You haven't gotten very far along so far.
He went back to his previous cliché. Well, we'll see what we see. Let you know later. Another hour or so went by, and sunset came on. I saw him start to get ready to go out over there. He put on his hat, put his hand in his pocket, and stood still looking at it for a minute, counting change, I guess. It gave me a peculiar sense of suppressed excitement, knowing they were going to come in the minute he left. I thought grimly as I saw him take a last look around. If you've got anything to hide, brother, now's the time to hide it. He left. A breath-holding interval of misleading emptiness descended on the flat. A three-alarm fire couldn't have pulled my eyes off those windows. Suddenly, the door by which he had just left parted slightly, and two men insinuated themselves one behind the other. There they were now. They closed it behind them, separated at once, and got busy. One took the bedroom, one the kitchen, and they started to work their way toward one another from those extremes of the flat. They were thorough. I could see them going over everything from top to bottom. They took the living room together, one cased one side, the other man the other. They'd already finished before the warning caught them. I could tell that by the way they straightened up and stood facing one another frustratedly for a minute. Then both their heads turned sharply, as at a tip-off by a doorbell that he was coming back. They got out fast. I wasn't unduly disheartened. I'd expected that. My own feeling all along had been that they wouldn't find anything incriminating around. The trunk had gone. He came in with a mountainous paper bag sitting in the curve of one arm. I watched him closely to see if he'd discover that someone had been there in his absence. Apparently he didn't. They'd been adroit about it. He stayed in the rest of the night, sat tight, safe, and sound. He did some desultory drinking. I could see him sitting there by the window, and his hand would hoist every once in a while, but not to excess. Apparently everything was under control. The tension had eased, now that the trunk was out. Watching him across the night, I speculated, why doesn't he get out? If I'm right about him, and I am, why does he stick around after it? That brought its own answer, because he doesn't know anyone's on to him yet. He doesn't think there's any hurry. To go too soon, right after she has, would be more dangerous than to stay a while. The night wore on. I sat there waiting for Boyne's call. It came later than I thought it would. I picked the phone up in the dark. He was getting ready to go to bed over there now. He'd risen from where he'd been sitting drinking in the kitchen and put the light out. He went into the living room, lit that. He started to pull his shirt tail up out of his belt. Boyne's voice was in my ear as my eyes were on him over there. Three-cornered arrangement. Hello, Jeff. Listen, absolutely nothing. We searched the place while he was out. I nearly said, I know you did. I saw it. But checked myself in time. And didn't turn up a thing, but... He stopped as though this was going to be important. I waited impatiently for him to go ahead. Downstairs in his letterbox, we found a postcard waiting for him. We fished it up out of the slots with bent pins, and...
And it was from his wife, written only yesterday from a farm up country. Here's the message we copied. Arrived okay. Already feeling a little better. Love, Anna. I said faintly but stubbornly, "You say, written only yesterday. Have you proof of this? What was the postmark date on it?" He made a disgusted sound down in his tonsils. At me, not it. The postmark was blurred. A corner of it got wet, and the ink smudged. All of it blurred? The year date, he admitted. The hour and month came out okay. August, 7:30 p.m. It was mailed at. This time I made the disgusted sound in my larynx. August, 7:30 p.m, 1937, or 1939, or 1942. You have no proof of how it got into that mailbox, whether it came from letter carrier's pouch or the back of some bureau drawer. Give up, Jeff, he said. There's such a thing as going too far. I don't know what I would have said. That is, if I hadn't happened to have my eyes on the Thorwald flat living room windows just then. Probably very little. The postcard had shaken me, whether I admitted it or not. But I was looking over there. A light had gone out as soon as he'd taken his shirt off. But the bedroom didn't light up. A match flare winked in the living room, low down, as if from an easy chair or sofa. With two unused beds in the bedroom, he was still staying out of there. "Boyne," I said in a glassy voice, "I don't care what postcards from the other world you've turned up. I say the man has done away with his wife. Trace that trunk he shipped out. Open it when you've located it, and I think you'll find her." And I hung up without waiting to hear what he was going to do about it. He didn't ring back, so I suspected he was going to give my suggestion a spin after all, in spite of his loudly proclaimed skepticism. I stayed there by the window all night, keeping a sort of death watch. There were two more match flares after the first, at possible half-hour intervals. Nothing more after that. So possibly he fell asleep over there. Possibly not. I had some sleep myself, and I finally succumbed to the flaming light of the early sun.